House Health and Social Service Committee to order. It is 3:05, April the 2nd, on 2013. Present is Representative Tarr, Representative Nagyak, Representative Reinbold, Representative Keller, and myself, Representative Higgins. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. Let's see here. I'd like to recognize our staff, which we have Butch Carver, which is the House Recording Secretary. The LIO moderator is Claire Gross. Paul Verhagen is my committee aide. If anybody needs anything, raise your hand. He'll come and see if we can help you out. A little housekeeping. Let's turn our cell phones off. We've been a very busy day, and some of us have not had lunch, so if your phone goes off, we want donuts. We want them now. So please, turn them off. Okay, let's see here. We're getting down to the end here fairly quickly. So today we have four items on the agenda. In order to get through them, we'll have to move quickly, but make sure that we get our point across and everyone has a chance to speak. But we still want to move quickly. With that said, we'll begin with Representative Stoltz on HRJ 14, delaying the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Then we'll move on to HB 54, and then we'll have a presentation by Dennis McCarve, Executive Director of the Alaska Children's Services. So we'll start with HJR 14, House Resolution 14, delaying the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Here to present the resolution is Representative Stoltz, which he is at the table. So let's begin.
Thanks, Chair Higgins and members of the committee. I'll keep my comments fairly brief. I'm Bill Stoltz. I represent House District 11 and communities of Northern Chugiak, Peters Creek, and Southern Met, Rural Mat Su. This resolution I drafted out of incredible concern for the actual implementation of the Affordable Care Act, of which our chief executive has now acceded. He likes to call Obamacare as well, so I'll just shorthand it and also call it Obamacare because I know he embraced the term, so I want to be consistent with what the nomenclature is. We know when the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare passed was not the most vetted piece of legislation. I think perhaps Representative Reinbold's sister is probably ahead of about 530-some members of Congress in that she read it and understands it. Chief Justice Roberts, in his Supreme Court opinion, clearly identified it for what it was, a massive tax increase, and it's on the private sector. The crux of my resolution is to delay implementation, and this is certainly only the gentlest of letters to our Congress and representation and others. And if we can even maybe peel off one of the members of our delegation, I think we'll have done pretty heady work. I know we have two of them already, so if we hit the trifecta, that this resolution might be one of the most important things we do, even if it's just from talking about it. But my goal is to not to oppose the act, which has been passed by Congress and upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, but to delay implementation until we do what Congress itself didn't do, and ask the federal government to totally examine all the employer costs and how this will impact our private sector. Subsequent to a time I introduced this, I contacted the National Federation of Independent Business. It's a group that represents small businesses throughout the country, and many of them in my district, I find even more so than the Chamber of Commerce, they really get to the meat and potato issues of what core of business. They're not social clubs. They're not lunch forums. These are advocacy groups that are watching and protecting the interests of the mom and pops and small businesses and even some larger that but primarily the ones that aren't large corporations, but the ones that make up the fabric of our economy. And this is something that scares them to death. And this is a very, the whole crux of this is pretty simple, is please don't implement this. and we still have not implemented it. It doesn't take effect, I believe, until 2014. I drafted this earlier, and I just been busy with a few other things, but until we do a full analysis of the deleterious impacts upon our economy, how many jobs are we going to lose? We've already seen the pre-reaction of the business communities, large and small, and not hiring people, laying off people, shifting to part-time, doing the things that tax codes, which and tax policies, of which is this is identifying this as such, is what ended up ultimately upholding this at the U.S. Supreme Court. Taxes affect behavior, and the application of this tax will affect employment and business. It has, and I think it'll only accelerate. So I don't know if I can nutshell it any better than that. I probably took even longer than I needed to, because I'm looking at a pretty savvy committee who understands business and the impacts and knows what a tax is, knows that that taxes affect behavior, and this is what they're hanging their hat on and why this is constitutional. It's one of the largest tax increases in the United States history. And it's much more than that.
Are there any questions for the representative? Well, good. All right. With that, though, we do have an amendment before us. And I guess at this point, I'm going to brief at ease. Let's go with testimony, public testimony, and we have some people online. Is there a Mark Regan in Anchorage?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Mark Regan.
Go ahead, Mark.
As Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Regan. I am an attorney with the Law Center of Houston. I am House 14, President Trump. Let me start at the end on what the state has done by not setting up a state exchange and by not actively regulating health insurance in the state. It has put itself in a position where there's very little it can do to try to stop the Affordable Care Act going into effect. People with disabilities, other people, now without health insurance, will not get health insurance unless the Affordable Care Act goes into effect. It's a very important thing for disabilities. You are looking at a resolution that has been drafted based on information which is slightly out of date. You look at the documents that are listed as supporting it. Many of those documents are from the fall of 2012. Many of the predictions about what this entity is likely to do stem from fall of 2012. We have about 6 months since most of those documents were drafted. I'm going to suggest to you that the business community is not as nervous about the Affordable Care Act now as it was back when those documents were drafted. And I would hope that you would delay consideration of this resolution until you have more and more balanced information before you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Ken, in Anchorage, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record, Ken.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Helander. I'm the Associate State Director for Advocacy at AARP. Speaking on behalf of the 95,000 AAR members in Alaska, I appreciate the opportunity to comment on HJR 14. AARP strongly objects to any effort to delay the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act at any level. HJR 14 does little to advance any meaningful purpose. The Affordable Care Act has been repeatedly upheld by Congress, by voters, and the United States Supreme Court, and progress towards its eventual full implementation continues. Rather than looking for ways to stand in the way and even to cede more control to federal government as a result, the legislature and the administration would do well to find ways to cooperatively improve the opportunities for all of us to obtain affordable health care insurance. Actually, the Affordable Care Act presents many opportunities for growth and for economic stimulus in Alaska. The 2012 Northern Economic Study of the federally subsidized expansion of Medicaid in Alaska concluded that during the first several years, for every dollar in state funding, an additional $15 in new federal dollars would generate. Approximately 4,000 new jobs would be created by 2017, generating $230 million more wages earned annually. The annual overall economic output for Alaska, based on business sales, would increase by $510 million by 2019, with the cumulative increase between 2014 and 2019 of $2.3 billion. Additionally, many other costs and offsets are likely due to decreased uncompensated care and overall improved health care previously untreated conditions. Although Governor Parnell has deferred the decision on Medicaid expansion for the moment, this opportunity still lies before us. Alaska has also opted not to create its own health insurance exchange or marketplace, and in so doing, the state has defaulted to federal involvement and oversight of a federally facilitated exchange. Here again, resistance to the Act, whether active or passive, can seize the opportunity to define our own exchange and how it will operate in Alaska. We strongly believe that implementing the Affordable Care Act in Alaska could emphasize the needs of the consumer and reflect the belief that all Alaskans have the right to both access affordable, comprehensive health care coverage. AARP is committed to working collaboratively with Alaska's legislature, administration, and other policy stakeholders to ensure that a successful, effective marketplace is established, providing all Alaskans with the health care coverage that they deserve. Thank you very much.
Thank you again. Seeing no more online, people online, is there anybody in the audience that wishes to speak? Well, Representative Nugget.
I have a question.
For Kent?
Can we get written comments made orally, if they have them, from the two people that we got just now? Can we get them?
Written?
Yeah, in written form?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, we can do that. Okay. Is there anybody in the office that wishes to speak?
Yes, that's it.
Come forward.
Thank you.
We don't have. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Peggy Ann McConaughey, and I live here in Juneau, Alaska. My husband and I own two companies. One company, Cycle Alaska, currently employs just under the amount necessary for mandated health care to kick in, or Obamacare. We're growing, or should I say, we want to grow. I'm here to support HDR 14, which would delay the implementation of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Here are some facts that we look at. Facts. The CBO estimated in the days leading up to the law being passed that the premium for the average family would increase by $2,100. The IRS estimates that a family plan in 2013 will be $20,000. Insurance costs for my husband and I have just increased 13%. Fact, the CBO estimates that about 7 million will lose their employer-based coverage. This is because any employer with 50 or more employees who does not offer coverage will pay a fine of $2,000 per employee. It is expected that many employers will drop coverage, pay the penalty, and recommend that employees purchase their health insurance in the state, federal, or partnership exchanges. My husband and I know business owners in Alaska who are not hiring or are dividing up their companies or trying to divide up their companies into units of fewer than 50 employees and reducing hours from 30, which is considered full-time, to 25 or 26 hours in order to avoid being required to provide health insurance. Fact. According to the CBO, there are about 1 trillion new taxes under Obamacare. As a growing company, we do not need or want any more taxes, as this administration currently finds it to be something that they need in order to be able to finance their deficit. Fact. And this health care law says it is going to help those with pre-existing condition. Baloney. I have a pre-existing condition. I have had health care always. My health care costs have gone up. But under Obamacare, my health care costs are going to go up even higher. And more importantly, it's going to take choices that I currently make out of my hands and put it into the Obama Health Care Act. I strongly urge you to pass HDR 14 to delay the implementation of Obamacare.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? All right. Seeing nobody else, we will close public testimony at this time. And now we can go to the amendment.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to put us a brief at ease, turn the gavel over to Representative Keller. And then I'll sit up there, right?
You can stay.
Brief at ease.
You can stay.
Can I stay here? Okay. Oh. The resolution, I felt that what we should try to do as a whereas is also have our congressional delegation in Washington also be team players and all work together for the same resolution. So basically that's what the amendment says. It just adds a whereas statement urging the Alaska congressional delegation to take action in Congress to delay the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So on page one, line one.
Wait, before we go there, if you would, Representative Higgins, sorry to interrupt.
I'm sorry.
I want to confirm that we have version U in front of us. That is our working document. That's the one that we got. And then you can go ahead and move U.1, okay. One label U.1. Amendment number one.
Amendment number one. So I have to move it.
Wait, go ahead. Okay, I'll move amendment number one, and will somebody...
Okay.
For discussion.
Okay, yeah.
Right. There we go. I was going to say, somebody has to.
Yeah.
Okay.
You.
Okay. Now we're ready. Oh.
Mr. Chairman, I am very appreciative of the committee process evolving and improving a bill, and I think what you're doing, I think, is very consistent with my stated intent of my testimony. If my the legislation that's drafted was deficient. I appreciate the pickup, the catch, as it were.
Just for clarification and for the record, what we're talking about is on page one, line one, deleting the word "and the governor" and inserting the words "the governor, comma, and the state's congressional delegation," and then it inserts a new further resolved on page five, line 12, which is further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature calls on the state's congressional delegation to introduce, sponsor, support, and vote to pass legislation in both houses of the U.S. Congress that will delay the implementation of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act until a full analysis of the economic effect of the act on Alaskans and Alaska can be clearly quantified, and goes on.
Excellent.
So that's it.
Yeah.
Any comments from the committee?
Nope.
Do you maintain your objection, Representative Burr?
I will remove it.
Okay. Seeing no. Did you have a comment?
Well,
I'll object again just to see if quid.
I just want to know if we're going to have further discussion after the after that amendment.
On the bill?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll remove my objection and the amendment carries. So we'll take another at ease and we'll give the gavel back to the chair.
Back on record. So with that, is there any questions for Representative Stoltz on the bill?
Just Oh, wait, Benny, you...
No, I'm not, for Representative Stokes. I just want to make a comment.
Go ahead.
And with the resolution, this important on the in the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, I'm just kind of surprised that there's not any further testimony from the rest of the state. I'm just kind of concerned. I haven't heard what the tribal governments in the state, the municipalities, some from the state, with a resolution this magnitude. I don't know why. I just want to know why. I'm questioning why there is not any further interest from the rest of the state. I'm just kind of concerned that we haven't heard what maybe the rest of the state would have to say about this. That's my concern.
Any other comments?
Good.
Representative Keller?
Partly in response to this is, I guess I am looking at the Obamacare all the time, and so we're I think in general terms, the state is very aware, of the questions surrounding it. As far as your specific question, maybe the sponsor would have some insights, but it's been properly posted and everything, so options there for folks to call. And I would just like to say that I really support this action, partly because it has changed so much. In the past, the projection on the bill, the cost that was promised was like $800 billion. And I think you'll see in the whereas is that it's almost triple that now that the Office of Management and Budget is projecting and continuing to go up. And when it passed, we weren't aware of all the taxes that were involved. And now there's is it one of the whereases talks about the 21 new taxes. And it's a burden. It just seems like it's a, unsustainable to me process that goes in place. And so I really support the sponsors bringing this forward to us.
I agree. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Chairman Higgins. And I would, I guess, respond to the AARP, who are not exactly a disinterested party in this whole business. They cut a deal to be able to market their insurance, as it's pretty well documented. And there's always a price. And, I will acknowledge things have changed in the last 6 months, but unlike the gentleman from AARP, I don't think they've gotten rosier, and the public and the private sector has become more acquiescent about what's happening. Frankly, if anything, the stakes are elevating even higher. Just in this last calendar week period, right before the holidays of Resurrection and until today, there have been numerous articles in the Daily News and the Times with our headlines, Feds Delay Small Business Healthcare Program, something that was supposed to be in place. Study, Health Overcall to Raise Claims Costs 32%. That's from March 26th. Small firms from New York Times, certainly that's a newspaper of record, I've heard. And it's small firms offer plan choices under health law delayed. That's April 1st, and I don't think that was an April Fool's joke from the Times, because they're the paper of record. They wouldn't do that. Just in the Daily News just today, Obamacare credits, and that has become the terminology. I think that newspaper endorsed him at least a couple of times. Obamacare credits could trigger surprise tax bills. So if anything, the situation has gotten more dire. The consequences far more severe. If anything, people just might have been numbed into just like a small business it is, by this cavalcade and avalanche of government regulation and taxes, maybe into submission at points. Say it's going to happen to us. But that's just one speculation. And we did hear from a lot of the private sector through the NFIB. It is the largest voice. small businesses, independent businesses. And frankly, why a lot of my constituents are here, they're working a lot harder to have to figure out how to pay for this. I mean, those are all, we live in a bubble down here. Frankly, when I go back, Mr. Chair, even in the middle of the summer, Bill, I thought you were down in Juneau. You know what? We put a pretty self-importance of what we're doing down here. People are out there raising their kids, scraping like heck to make a living. I'm not surprised that we don't have an avalanche of people other than some of the folks that are tied in to the, that have made deals to benefit under this, government nonprofit entities and so forth that are advocates of it. So I'm not shocked. There are some issues. Representative Nyack is, there were some short-term beneficial benefits for some of the tribal organizations. I'd be careful about having a lot of trust in that long-term. What the federal government gives, it can yank away and does routinely. So those 30 pieces of silver can melt down to eviscerate into nothing.
Representative Keller?
Yeah, if I could just comment again. One of the tensions in Obamacare is in the arena of the elderly, and I know elderly folks, ARP, of course, represent retired persons. And the Obamacare cuts huge amounts out of Medicare. And Medicare is a is something that many of us have paid into our whole lives. And what the cuts mean is that the providers, the hospitals, for example, have to pick up the difference as Medicare is reduced. And what that will do in very general terms of the way I see it is more and more people will be become dependent on a needs-based program, the Medicaid program that is there. And as a sponsor just pointed out, you know, the government can take away, and they have in Medicare. And I just really worry. The seniors actually are one of my biggest concerns of why I'd like to see this delayed and give some real thought to how we're going to take care of those among us that need it the most. And I think there's just a built-in tension in Obamacare and that, the huge cuts in the Medicare and then the offered increase in the needs-based. And it just seems like there'll be a movement toward those that are going to need to have more help, you know. And it just, we need to move slow down. We need to get these things answered.
If I could just close with my comments, as you notice, I have focused my objections to immediate implementation on just one narrow focus. We could spend a very lengthy series of committee meetings picking this whole national plan apart, and it's the concern about how it affects the private sector and the fabric of the small businesses. Government can't give us anything unless they yank it away from someone else first, and that's what a lot of this is about. So I'm trying to speak away from that's not my favorite team, maybe the Yankees.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Nagy.
Thank you. If I may. Well, personally, my wife and I have very good insurance. I'm not worried about me. I'm just worried about those people who won't have an opportunity to benefit from whatever is coming down the pike. But those of us who've worked all their lives have built in through some plans that we will be taken care of when we get older. And I'm just concerned about some of the people who can't afford to pay for their insurance. And I'm thankful that my colleague next to me has some concerns also. Maybe we can address that sometime during the process. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a comment?
Just a comment.
Well, let's keep them short. We got to move on, so go ahead.
I just want to say thanks for bringing this up. I think it's important. I think it's important to look out for the fabric of America that's holding our economy together. This is an unbelievable bill, and I think it's really important that we slow this process down and take it. I think we need to do due diligence, and I think it's really important. So I'm just happy that it was brought before us.
Thank you. Representative Targhee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple points. in preparing, and I passed out a couple of documents you can share with the sponsor's office, wanted to go back, you know, and compare sort of the history of, you know, where this came from. So the one article references that. And, you know, I know we talked, for example, a lot last night on the floor about finally doing something. So I think what we want to be careful about in this context, and the Washington Post article is about this, that, you know, we've been talking about doing something, and this goes back to the early 90s when the individual mandate was first discussed, and was trying to look into the history of that. And in fact, the individual mandate, which is sort of the crux of the whole package, is something that was forwarded by and supported by our congressional delegation, including Ted Stevens and Frank Murkowski, and then also endorsed by the Heritage Foundation, which is known as a, you know, pro-business conservative think tank. So was just kind of interested in that history. I think it's important for us to kind of look back at, just in the context of thinking about how we need to do something. I know this was, the catalyst was, you know, just rising healthcare costs, really crippling businesses. And so, you know, I know we may not have gotten it perfect, but I wouldn't want us to, you know, sort of kick the can down the road and not actually address the issue. And the second sheet, you know, one of the things I am very interested in terms of our efforts is making sure that as many Alaskans as possible have health insurance, have access to affordable health insurance. And the state, it turns out, with the highest number of insured individuals is Massachusetts, under the, you know, what folks could call Romney Care plan. And so the table just compares that. And very similar, although the Massachusetts model is actually more restrictive in terms of the employer mandate requiring coverage for companies with more than 11 employees, the federal law doesn't have an employer mandate until 50 employees. So thought that was very interesting, that it was quite a bit more restrictive in terms of that. And actually,
Representative Tarr, mm-hmm. We're not comparing Massachusetts care to Obamacare or Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. So let's wrap this up.
So my comments, I think, are valid, and I want to go on the record, and I don't appreciate being shortened, because we're having this, it's a very important issue, and as the representative next to me said, I don't think, you know, 35 minutes in committee over something that affects thousands and thousands of Alaskans is too much time. But the point, and I'll share this with anybody in the audience and members of the media, is just that in looking at where they've achieved really high numbers of insured individuals, and thinking if that's our goal, that we might want to look at components of that plan that was able to achieve that. I'm certainly no expert on this, but just think that these are important pieces of information that we want to have as we're sort of developing our positions and thinking about how we might achieve the goal of having more Alaskans insured. So,
thank you. And not that I wanted to cut you short, it's just that I've heard arguments about the Romney Care, and Romney Care was about Massachusetts only, not about any other state. So it's comparing apples to oranges. It's completely different, and that's why the numbers are different. So that's why whenever people start to bring up Romney Care, I say no. That's you're comparing two different things completely. But that's another debate that's going to happen probably, Representative Stoltz, that you'll have. Is there any other comments? Having heard the presentation of this resolution, do I have a motion to move it from the committee?
I would love to make a motion and a comment first. You know, I really think we need to really go slow on this, if I could. The number that, the statistic that sticks with me, and it's one I can always come up with, is in 2010, the ICER study showed that Alaskans spent $7.5 billion in health care for Alaskans, and that's projected to double. And Obamacare, at a time, it looked like maybe there was some hope there, some thought, you know, on controlling the costs. And since then, it has gone up just astronomically, and we're in a very dangerous position. $7.5 billion is approximately half of all of the earnings of all Alaskans put together. All the earnings in Alaska, about $15 billion. And if it's projected to double, the point is that something will change with our health care. We're in a situation where we're heading for a cliff. We're going to see a change, and how that change happens can affect lives of elderly, lives of a lot of people in the United States, but in the state of Washington. We need to move slow and there's work being done, and we need to keep beefing up that work to find solutions to reducing the cost. And we're on this ramp that is just going to kill us. With that, I would like to move HGR 14 version uniform out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal, zero fiscal.
Hearing no objections, the resolution moves from committee. And with that, we'll take an added. For placement of child in need of aid, sponsored by Representative Gara, Les Gara. And what do we? We don't have the representative here.
Mr. Chair.
Either one of them.
If I move the CS for HB 134 version R as our working document.
No object for discussion on the changes.
Were you on 134?
No, no, no. 54.
You said 54.
I said 134. I meant 54.
Okay. You meant 54. Okay. Strike all that. We're going to start all over again.
They're both version R that we're working with. Sorry about that.
I'm going to remake the motion.
HB 54, 28LS0202 Romeo, HB 54. I move that as a working committee.
Again,
P Romeo.
Discussion.
Okay. All right. All right, let's put your name on the record and move forward.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Toby Smith, and I'm an aide for Representative Les Guerra.
And for the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staffed Representative Steve Thompson.
And we apologize, they are both currently in House Finance Committee today, not able to be here, so we are presenting on their behalf.
That's okay.
And I will just move forward with briefly describing, overviewing the bill, if that's okay. In essence, there are three sections to this bill. Section 1 basically adds a new section to AS 47.10, requiring that a supervisor in the Office of Children's Services, also known as OCS, certify in writing that a search for non-custodial parents, adult family members, and appropriate adult family friends of the child has been conducted. OCS must notify these adults of the child's removal within 30 days, unless there are extenuating circumstances. And this section also codifies existing OCS policy related to extended family searches and adds a requirement of supervisor certification. And then moving on to Section 2, Section 2 adds a reference to the new section of statute established in Section 1 and requires that due diligence be conducted to locate extended family members before the child is placed in a foster home. And also, I believe in Version R, there is a Section 3, which basically provides for emergency placement of a child while conducting due diligence. So this bill doesn't cost the state any money. What it does is address an accountability issue. We just want to make sure that frontline caseworkers are doing the work that they are supposed to be doing, and that's in the best interests of foster youth, by requiring that a supervisor sign off when a caseworker has done a due diligence search. So that's the overview of the bill. And if it pleases the committee, we do have Amanda Mativier online, who has been working with this bill and with foster youth for over 10 years. So if there are questions, I would ask that we defer to her. And I believe there's also audience members as well.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, I have a question. Has the department indicated that there may be a danger in, do they feel that this is taking away an option that they may have now of not contacting somebody that may be perceived and understood to be a danger to the child? Are they uncomfortable in any way? Have they indicated anything like that?
If it pleases the committee, I would defer to the department if there's a representative here.
When she comes up, it doesn't have to be known.
Okay. Yeah, if it,
I just was wondering if you had discussed that.
I have not personally. Through the chair, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Any other questions from the committee? Well, I think then before we move on, let's go ahead and open this up for open the floor for public testimony. You said we do have somebody online. Did you want them to speak, or if we have questions?
She's also online to testify as well through the chair.
Do I need to go ahead? We're okay with accepting this version?
Yeah.
I'll remove my objection, by the way, so that it's the working document.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Nope, that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And hang around, because we're going to probably call you up again. So did he want us to speak with Amanda? Okay, well, I'll tell you what. At this time, I'll open the floor to public testimony. Is there anybody that wants to talk? And then, seeing none, do we have anybody online? Amanda, I know you're online. Can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes. Did you want to go ahead and say a few words?
Yeah. Representative Higgins, members of the committee, I appreciate you hearing this bill again, and I've given testimony on before. My name is Amanda McKeever, and I'm representing Facing Foster Care in Alaska, and I just wanted to highlight that while it's already a requirement, it's in federal laws and the Federal Foster Connections Act, and it's already an OCS policy. This bill really just ensures compliance with high staff turnover and heavy workloads. It ensures that caseworkers are doing extensive relative search and notifying families if a child comes into custody. And while it doesn't cost any money to the state, I assume that it could potentially save the state money in terms of searching for foster homes, as well as paying the cost to keep children in long-term foster care if we can get them out quickly and in with relatives. So it's really in the best interest of children. So I'll be available for questions. But again, thank you for hearing this again.
Thank you, Amanda.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, I have a couple questions I'd like to ask the Division of Office of Children.
We're going to bring them.
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm getting ahead of you.
That's okay. Okay. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to speak to this, to have testimony? And seeing none online. Amanda, we're going to keep you around if we have questions. But we would like to bring the department up now. And can you put your name on the record for us?
Hello, my name is Christy Lawton. I'm the director for the Office of Children's Services.
Okay. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Christy, thank you. For the record, I've really been impressed with your diligent and good work. Thank you. My question has to do with, it's kind of a general thing, but this requires you to notify this list of people. Are they, are you required to do that now? Is this going to force you to contact, for example, a non-custodial parent that you may not want to contact because of some discomfort that is come between a social worker and a child? Do you feel like that this is a restriction on you? Do you have to, by other law, contact all these people that are listed here?
Representative Keller, through the chair, this does not change the requirements that we currently have in terms of we would already be contacting non-custodial parents.
Okay. Then a follow-up?
Go ahead.
Would a non-custodial parent include a parent that had lost parental rights in the court?
Representative Keller, through the chair, I do not believe that it would, no.
Okay. if you could confirm that, I don't want to stop any action on the bill today, but I would like to know that one, because there are situations where there's reasons why the parent is not a custodial parent, I'm not sure that notification would serve the best interest of the child, you know, in some cases that I'm painfully aware of, and I'm sure you are. And so, anyway, if we need a clarification in the wording here, I'd like to know, and we can take care of that. I believe this goes right to the floor, and we can handle it there if need be. Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Seen.
Thank you.
Oh, hold on for a second. That's right. Let the record show the Representative Seaton has joined us probably about 15 minutes ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was testimony that this is required under federal law, and it's also policy of the department at the current time. Is that correct? So that if this is federal law, then the concerns that Representative Keller is bringing up, those are probably already covered. Is that correct?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, there are elements in here that are addressed in federal law. and there are a couple of small additions that are not currently included in policy or specified in law.
Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And from your perspective, are those additions reasonable and beneficial for the foster child?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I think that they're reasonable and certainly they could help provide some enhancements, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Well, you know, the reason why this bill is before us is because we had discussions with you guys on what we could do to make this happen without going to statute with it. Can you explain why the department has reasons for why it doesn't believe that they wanted to go that route?
Mr. Chairman, what I had offered is that there was a distinction between regulations and my ability to change policy, and the preference was regulations, and there was concerns about that not being the best forum when policy can do the similar, can make the same effect as regulations. I'm not an expert on regulations, but generally the bulk of what our policy and procedures and our day-to-day practice covers in terms of giving direction to staff, those are not covered in regulations. Those cover a lot of things related to foster care licensing, payment issues, more administrative technical elements. It does not cover practice issues, and it seemed to be not a good fit for this particular item. So that was our preference, that really not be the right place. It certainly is allowable according to what Department of Law has said, but it was just not the preferred avenue.
It is, you know, one of the things that I ran on was bureaucracy. I think we've got so many layers and layers of bureaucracy that we straddle you with. Is this another layer of bureaucracy that you feel will be a hindrance to you more than something that's going to help your department?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't see this element as bureaucracy. I think that the elements that are added here certainly are components of good practice that we expect and have no problem improving if there's areas where we could improve. The amount of work, just in terms of the various steps that we have to take, there's less to that in terms of my ability to change policy, which I can change, and it stays in place for a very long time. So it certainly is something strong. That's what our staff and our workers follow. It seemed not necessarily rising to the level of needing a statute, but I don't see it as bureaucracy, the intent and the meaning behind this. It's certainly important, and it can have a positive impact on families.
If this does go to statute, do you think that this would invite more litigation into your department if you didn't sign or do whatever the statute is saying compared to what you're doing now?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't anticipate that, since the majority of these elements we already are doing in various ways in practice. So I don't anticipate this opening up the door for other litigation.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Keller.
I don't know how we're doing on time, but just very, very generally speaking, if I could, Mr. Chair, the reason for notification is presumably that somebody that cares about the child could then get involved in the placement of that child. And the placement of that child is a subjective decision that largely we leave at the discretion of OCS in a situation like this. There's nothing in this bill that implies a preference. Am I right or am I wrong? I mean, would a relative be given preference automatically over an adult family friend, for example, all else being equal? I mean, how do you decide and make decisions like that?
Representative Keller, this does outline a preference for placement, but it's a preference standard that we already use, and specifically this is a preference standard for non-Indian, non-Alaska Native children. So yes, in terms of the priority ranking of who we have to choose from, relatives come first. In this case, family friends that have, I mean, these just aren't family friends that the parents met yesterday. These are people that can demonstrate they have a connection to the child and a relationship. They would come next. And then the unrelated licensed foster caregiver would be the least preferred option. So it does provide preferences, but they are the same preferences that we are, by practice, currently using.
Thank you. And just for clarification, follow up, if I could.
Go ahead.
That information I asked for, I would like to see it. I understand it's coming to judiciary next, and so we don't have to worry about any form of it. So
yes.
Good. Any other questions or comments? Good. Well, having heard testimony from the department and from the public, I now will close testimony. Do I have a motion to pass this bill out of committee?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I'd move we're dealing with HB 54, and that's 2002 Romeo, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objections, we'll move this bill out of committee. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease while we make signatures. All right, we have a presentation today, and our presenter will be Dennis, is it McCavill?
McCarvel.
The Executive Director of the Alaska Children's Services. Go ahead and let's put yourself on the record. And
my name is Dennis McCarvel. I'm the President and CEO of Alaska Children's Services, an organization that is dedicated to the well-being of children of Alaska. We have been focused on serving one child and one family at a time since our inception, which was in 1890 as the Jesse Lee Home in Unalaska. I'm accompanied today by a long-time board member and past president of Alaska Children's Services, Mary Ann Pease. I've been in Alaska a relatively short time. In fact, just a bit over 2 years. And during that time, I've been struck by the number of children that we serve at Alaska Children's Services that come from all parts of the state of Alaska. Beyond being struck, I read the life histories of many of these children. And it's hard for me to hold back the tears at times. What always gets to me is the amount of suffering that they go through just to get to treatment. I know that it really doesn't have to be that way. Now, I'm not naive. I do know that what we're seeing is generations and generations of patterns that will not be changed by one simple program. What I do know is that we cannot sit back and wait for things to change. Too much suffering is at stake. Our proposal presents a chance to do something. We at Alaska Children's Services are proposing that we take what we know to help that helps children in Anchorage and start providing those services in the village. Let me state it clearly. Alaska Children's Services has been very successful at treating children from villages for many years. But that success comes with a price. Each child and family must first get to Anchorage to get to our services. The price they pay in suffering is only eclipsed by the price they pay in loss of culture, family, and community relationships. The response that I've heard to this statement is that we in Alaska can't provide a treatment provider in each village, nor is it feasible with our workforce issues. We believe that answer is no longer the right answer. Because of the transportation and technology advances that we've made, we can overcome many of these problems. Alaska Children's Services trains over 300 individuals in Anchorage and over 200 individuals through
let me,
our...
Let me hold you up just for one second. The presentation is this... hold on here. You guys should have it in the
this
back.
One here?
Statewide.
Statewide.
Yeah. It's just... no, didn't. Let's make sure everybody has it.
You don't have it? Okay. Sent out. I got mine.
So we don't have copies of it. Let's take a brief at ease real quick.
Okay. All right, let's go. All right. So Alaska Children's Services trains about 300 individuals in Anchorage. We serve another 200 across the state through a grant that we have with the Division of Behavioral Health. And what we find is we are training people that care about people. And we are training individuals that not necessarily have all kinds of credentials. They're usually young people who are very interested in serving and quite often are looking at going on to a professional degree. The other group is really just individuals that just care a lot about kids, and that's their knack. If you look at that group of people, they don't have the credentials, they don't have the right to have the success that they are seeing, that we are seeing with them. So what we are proposing is that we begin to take that training out to villages, to individuals that care. Begin to take that the clinical support that we have and bring it out to the villages. Get the knowledge that the field of health and human services has gathered and provided where it can do the most help. We now have the technology to allow us to do this. The statewide behavioral health-based training and delivery system would offer training and support to elders, to grandparents, to aunties, to teachers, other interested parties, as well as the children. Our objective is to work collaboratively with people in the village to wrap troubled youth and families with informed, clinical-supported individuals who can make a difference early when the problems are just becoming evident. We believe that each village and each family needs will be different. But as we are there to help the individual family, we believe that will leave behind a cadre of individuals who can help not only that family, but also the next family and the next family and the next family. Our goal is to take the training that we use in Anchorage and throughout the state and blend it with the cultures of each village. Our approach will be to provide a combination of in-person and distance-based services in collaboration with people on the ground like behavioral health aides. Our staff will travel to villages to build relationships and to provide services, then augment that with distance-based initiatives. We plan to stay in a village as long as the invitation is extended, with the goal of leaving behind the knowledge base that we will help, that will help them in the future. A list of the training we believe will be helpful and are ready to adapt are as follows: mental health first aid, gatekeeper training, brain-based trauma-informed training, source of strength, trauma 101, parenting with love and logic, Presley Ridge treatment foster home curriculum, fetal alcohol spectrum training. Other areas that that we already are trained that we can adapt to village needs would be managing aggressive behavior, building therapeutic relationships, core competencies for direct care, basic counseling training, and bullying intervention. While distance and in-person training is the foundation of the services that we will provide, we believe that another key element of our success with troubled young people and their families is the ability to provide clinical support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Since we are always open with staff working around the clock, we in Anchorage can provide both telephonic and in-person crisis intervention. What we're proposing, we will be able to provide, perhaps not the in-person because of the distance, but telephonically. We could do telebehavioral health, telebehavioral assessments, individual and family therapy, crisis intervention, all this through either existing telebehavioral health networks or a laptop or any place where you can get a Wi-Fi connection. Other services that are available that they're interested in providing is the use of a cell phone technology to provide mentoring services for children with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. We're aware that all services are somewhat limited in some villages, but not all villages. And it's time for us to begin to take a look at where we can provide this service. Some might say that technology has been harmful in ways to the people of the villages, but we believe that technology also can be one of the solutions. Our purpose here today is to make you aware of an $8.5 million capital request. That's and we know that that if you would help us approve this and get this program ramped up, we can then serve these children. And if we were able to serve 66 children and prevent them from coming to Anchorage to treatment in a residential program, we pay for this. What makes a difference here is that we need to have the folks that really know about the about this kind of service, the House HES committee, talk to finance to move the capital budget along.
And I would just like to add through the chairs and the rest of the committee, I'm Mary Ann Peace for the record. I'm past president of the board for Alaska Children's Services, and I am still on the board. I've been on the board for about 15 years. We as a board are very, in addition to the social and holistic mission of Alaska Children's Services, are very focused on a business type approach. And one of the things that we challenged Dennis and his team to do is to deliver a business plan that would show an overall reduction in the amount of funding that was necessary for this very expensive residential treatment. $350 a day per child. That's the price tag today. That's not even bringing into account the $8 million plus that goes outside for services even outside of Alaska. So what we wanted to do is say, what can we do as a preventative measure to reduce this huge burden on the state? And what we looked at, and the federal government for that matter, so what we looked at is the ability through this approach to implement a very proactive approach to mental health training in all of our communities. We use the word villages, but it's all of our communities throughout Alaska, with this huge in-depth resource of the premier agency, Alaska Children's Services, and their host of experts and counselors that could hopefully bring the messages out on prevention and proactive steps prior to actually having them in our residential treatment program. So it's kind of an innovative approach. When Dennis was living in Nebraska before he came here, he looked at Alaska as being one of those places where we had a different approach to mental health for children. And what he saw is a very, willingness to be very comprehensive in terms of all of our agencies working together. And he said, that's why it was so important. Also out there on the table, you will see the letter of support from the Alaska Tribal Health Consortiums. You will also see, and if you speak with Jesse, what is his name?
Jeff Jesse.
Jeff Jesse. If you speak with Jeff Jesse, you will also hear his acknowledgement and strong support for this program. And I just wanted to add that from a board perspective as well.
The idea is that we really need the help to get this ramped up. It's at this point we're doing baby steps, but you know our dream, our hope is to begin to really bring this to scale so that we can really make a difference in not just one village, but multiple villages across the state.
We had through an acquisition of the land, our facility is mostly located right across from Service High School, and one of our first members of the treatment program was the actual Benny Benson, who of course did the state flag. So every year on State Flag Day, we honor Benny Benson and our agency, and we'd like to also invite all of you to attend, and we'll leave behind the information on that as well.
Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah.
Representative Keller.
Do I understand that it's kind of a different model that you're embarking on here, and so all the details aren't in as far as whether you're looking at regions or just exactly the nuts and bolts of the thing are still future, am I right?
Representative Keller, through the chair, that's somewhat correct. We are working with ANTHC, and we are looking at ways that we could operate in villages. But it's very important for us to be invited in. So our job at this point really is working on that invitation, is to help people understand what we might be able to do together. And then each village will look different because it'll be based on what those villages are looking for. So that's why it feels, as I think you've stated correctly, that it's still in the, you know.
Watch out!
Whoa. Follow up.
Follow up.
We all got missed. the follow up is that it's a different model in the sense that you're thinking about using electronics to reach out. I mean, it's a residential treatment center that you have, and you're proposing things that are outside of that right now, right?
Right.
I mean,
well, Representative Keller, through the chair. We actually do provide in-home services in the Anchorage area. So part of this would really be to take the kind of in-home service we do, train people up to do that in villages in order, so that's the part that we're already doing.
Go ahead.
I know we're hurting.
That's okay.
If you describe that, and I missed it, I apologize. The just roughly, what your annual budget now, and how many kids a year do you serve? Where are we looking at?
Sure, Representative Keller, through the chair. Our annual budget this year is $14 million. We serve about 150 kids any given day. 55 of those are in our residential program. 65 are in our treatment foster homes, and then the rest are in the community, where we're working with kids in their families, trying to keep them at home and trying to prevent them from more suffering, but also from moving on into higher levels of care.
Just a quick comment. Thank you for your work. I mean, your services. Appreciate it. Thank you.
So you're proposing that $8.5 million capital request. That
correct.
What's the... I guess the breakdown of that $8.5 million. In other words, where are you going to put the money? How are you going to use it? Where's that going?
Well, it's really going into a building where we would be hosting training, either in person or through technology, and it would also be a center that we would be inviting other agencies in to use in order to build on what we are, the plan that we're proposing.
And it also comes with a fairly hefty technology component.
Right.
I mean, getting the video, the bandwidth, and the technology that has to accompany this program, you're seeing, a large part of that will have to be
with the physical equipment that needs to go out to some of the communities.
So in your so the building square footage is 14,925. I think that's what you got down here.
Yes.
So the 8.5 million is to help build the building.
Build
correct.
The building.
Is that what it was? And to fill it with all the equipment you guys think you need.
Correct.
To make sure this program. You know, one of the questions that you know, and I talk with people is and you hit it right on, nail right on the head there when you said you've been talking with ANTHC and working with the tribal communities, is that you have to work closely with them and to develop programs like this, you know, all the stakeholders have to get together and make it work. And what I've seen, you know, being here in Juneau, is that we have a lot of really good intentions. We really do. A lot of good people trying to do a lot of good work. But I think we need to consolidate our efforts with different organizations, and I think we can cover a lot more people as long as we do that. So I encourage you to continue to work with them and come up with a game plan that will work, that everyone is on board with. Because I believe you're on the right track.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, any other?
I have
Representative Seaton.
I have another meeting I have to go to, so I'm just waiting.
He's just trying to get out.
Yeah, right, right.
Representative Seaton, you can leave if you need to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, one thing that Dennis didn't mention, but we have a high percentage, probably over 50% of the kids do indeed come from areas outside of, I would say, Anchorage, Matsu, Kenai, that area right there. So fairly high percentages serve from outside.
And at this point, we are, you know, we have a pilot that we're doing with Lower Kalskek. And again, it's just it's a village that asked for help, and we've been working to develop a program so that we could go in there. They have the technology availability for us to do that. So that's our first pilot. We're also working with a program up in Nome to do telebehavioral health at this point.
One of the we had a presentation earlier this year on an entity trying to create a behavioral health aides, like the CHAP program, mm-hmm. you know, in the villages. And from what I'm seeing, you guys are kind of on the same line, kind of trying to do the same thing. So have you worked with that?
We have. The difference that we're really focusing on informal helpers. We're really focusing on the grandparents that are raising the kids or the aunties that are raising the kids or, you know, the support that's around each of the youth. We would work hand in hand with a behavioral health aide, you know, as another way to augment their services, and that's the work that we're trying to do with ANTHC and actually the University of Alaska Fairbanks with their training programs. We're working with them to do some collaboration, but you know, our focus is really on those that are raising these children. Which it could include and does include in time, the parents of the children themselves. One of the things that we do today is we take the very same training that we provide for our staff and offer it to the parents of the children that we're serving. And we're very successful at getting that knowledge base in. You know, when it comes to something like fetal alcohol syndrome, the earlier that we can give them the tools to raise those children, the better off that child is. So those are the kind of things that we would be doing, and we would be doing in conjunction with the others, as you pointed out.
And probably my last question here is sometimes we build things with monies that we get, not understanding the maintenance of whatever we're building.
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked at, if we do go down this road, what is our annual money that we're going to have to put into this to keep this program alive and going?
Right.
Have you seen that? Or
yeah, we've certainly looked at that. First of all, when it comes to maintenance, you know, we've looked at, you know, the maintenance of the building, for example.
Right.
And the good news there is that, of course, it's going to be built next to our campus,
on our campus,
so that we have the maintenance staff to take care of the building. Obviously, there's upkeep to the building. What we are looking at as far as funding the programming are existing funds. But the idea is, for example, anytime we can
We can do Medicaid any time of the clinical work that we can provide face-to-face Medicaid. Then what we're trying, what we'll do is we're gonna move from spending $350 a day to a lot less money if we can prevent kids from moving out. So a lot of that is there. A lot of the
existing funding.
The funding is existing. The other part of that would be some of the prevention grants that are out there, and we think that we'd be eligible for them.
Right. So that I understand it, then what you're saying is that you'll be billing Medicaid to help pay for the program. Is that that's how you're looking at doing? Okay, that's
anything
your model.
That we
okay.
could, yeah, anything that we could bill Medicaid, we will Medicaid for that.
But under the model, of course, it would be much less in this program on the preventative side than the full residential treatment side. So there's that cost savings there that has been built into our model.
Right. You're saving us on the other.
That's right.
That's what you're trying to
do. Yeah. Right. At least early intervention. Medicaid wouldn't pay for prevention as much as they would early intervention.
Right. That's right.
Representative Knight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the lines of the maintenance costs and all that related to a new building, I would suggest that new technology be used in order to reduce costs, like different kind of lights.
Right.
And, you know, all that stuff that saves money for with new technology. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And that is definitely a very good point and something we looked at. I don't know if many of you know Barbara Cash with Rim Architects, but she is the one that donated the building design and the diagrams that we're using, and having it very energy efficient and everything else with high technology is definitely kind of the premier platform that we're using. Yes.
Any other questions from the committee? No? Well, thank you. For your presentation, it was very good, and I appreciate it. And you know, I think I speak pretty much for everybody here that we'll do our best to make sure that we keep programs like yours alive and maybe expanding. We'll see as we continue to go.
Great,
because I know it helps us in the state. So with that, we thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we'll take a quick brief at ease again. Back on record again. All right. So now we have before us a blank committee substitute for HB 134 version R. I'll entertain a motion to adopt committee substitute HB 134R as a working document.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt CS for HB 134, 28 LS 0303 Romeo.
And I would object and ask the sponsor to state the changes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charles Ginshard, staff to Representative Costello. Representative Costello is currently in the Finance Committee, so I appreciate the opportunity to present on her behalf. Before you is a blank CS, proposed CS for House Bill 134, version R. The reason for changes from the previous version was to address specific concerns brought up by members at the previous testimony. We'll satisfy the members. We'll go ahead and go through those changes. The first change appears Section 1, AS 4101031A. This section has been amended by adding legislative intent language guiding the department's eligibility regulations for this program. The language was added to ensure that the event that Medicaid services were to expand, the scope of individuals eligible for this program would remain the same. The language appears on as numbers 1 through 5, paragraph A. That's page 1, beginning on line 12. And if you will recall, at previous testimony, I read through a bulleted list that guides what the current regulations are, and it was requested that Ledge Legal insert similar, if not verbatim, language here. The second change occurs, Section 1, AS 4701031, paragraph C. Specifically, it's on page 2, line 20. This section has been amended by adding language to clarify that non-local transport of medication compliance packaging is by mail or package delivery service. That was to address a concern of another member of the committee that we were not limiting it simply to USPS, that it could also be FedEx, UPS, etc. The third change that occurred is Section 1, AS 4701031, paragraph E, number 2, the definition of units of use has been replaced, the definition of units of use has been inserted to replace the previous definition of medication compliance packaging, and the bill has been updated accordingly to reflect that new definition. And that concludes the changes from the previous version.
Okay. Sure.
Representative Keller.
I just wanted to commend you. That the changes really reflect my concerns. I appreciate it.
Representative Keller, through the chair. Thank you.
Let's see. Is there anyone who you need to call on to provide testimony or questions?
Not to my knowledge, Mr. Chairman.
When you get a chance, I would like to hear from Mr. Chair from the department.
And that's what we'll do. And let's bring the department up.
Thank you, Chairman Higgins. For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Healthcare Services.
Okay. Representative Keller?
Thanks. I don't know if you listened to the first part of the meeting, but we passed a resolution that asked the Congress to slow down on Obamacare simply because of the cost. And because I am painfully aware of the rising costs of health care and the pending cliff that we're heading for on this issue, it's going to be very difficult for me to vote for something that is expanding services that we're offering under Medicaid. So I'd like to get your answer, your response to whether or not we are expanding Medicaid with this CS that we're starting for.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, we currently pay dispensing fees and MedSet fees right now in Medicaid. This bill provides for statutory requirements that we continue to do that with some specific provisions. As noted in our fiscal note, we think that would increase some costs. I think another issue that's question that has been raised is, will this expand the number of providers? There are criteria in the legislation that defines qualified providers that are somewhat different than our current regulations. Whether or not that specifically will expand the number of providers that qualify, we can't say, but that's possible. In addition to the fiscal impacts you've already addressed.
Can I get a follow up?
Go ahead, follow up.
Yeah.
I would suggest if you do this, it's your last.
In our attempt to expand to make sure that all the pharmacies in Alaska, the mom and pop type pharmacies and the bigger pharmacies, to be real blunt, you know, can all compete.
Hold on. Let me take a brief of these real quick. Okay, now redo your question again so I can hear it. So.
I will. Could I ask, Mr. Chair, is the intent to hold this bill over one time, or do you made up your mind? If you haven't, I will. You haven't made up your mind yet?
The intent will probably be to hold it over until Thursday. Yeah. We're going to hear whatever we can. Let's take care of as much as we can today. And then we'll probably pass it out.
Because it makes a difference on how I'm going to ask my question. And that's why I interrupted. Okay. Because I really would like to see the department come forward with exactly what the increases are, and so we can evaluate them. I think it's, even though I really like this bill, I like the service, I think that we have to be very cautious when we are at this stage of the healthcare, rising healthcare costs, that we know. If we're going to recommend an increase, we want to know what that increase is. So there will be a new. Are you saying? And I want to just clarify. Are you saying that the CS for the original, or the fiscal note for the original CS applies to the CS? Or are you saying that you're going to reevaluate it and come back with a cost and the specifics?
Through the chair, the amendments. made to date from the version we used for the fiscal note, which was version P, we do not believe have significantly altered our estimates.
Okay. That's what I wasn't quite clear on. Thank you. And then the other question I had was, in your opinion, did we do something to make it easier for the smaller pharmacies to make sure? I mean, in the sections B and C that lay out the criteria that is to be used, is there anything there that you would view in your professional opinion as prohibitive for the smaller pharmacies?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, you're probably wandering beyond my area of expertise. Right now, we do have a requirement that to be paid the fee, you have to do a certain percentage volume of Medisets. So in that sense, this would, the language of the bill does not require that kind of volume. So that would be a requirement we wouldn't place on the pharmacies. However, what I can't say, because I'm not the expert, is whether the requirements as stated are sort of equally limiting or comparable in limiting, and I just apologize.
Fine. If I could, one more follow-up.
Go ahead.
Whatever, though, we can be assured that the fee that you come up with will reflect what is there now specified in statute, so business can respond appropriately. So the only real question I have is your evaluation of the expansion. You know, as long as we're holding this over, you don't have to answer that now. If we were planning on moving it, then I'd push a little harder to get an answer. So, thanks.
What's the, remind us what the fiscal note is again?
Six.
It's 1 point. I just don't have it in front of me. That's why it's.
I think it's 848
from the state. 848. But it's like a 50-50. Yeah. Okay. Here we go. Yes. It starts in FY14, Mr. Chair, as 414,000. That's because we assume one quarter's implementation. Given the need to promulgate regulations and get approval from CMS. And then the first full year which these requirements would apply, we projected it would be $1,657,000.
Okay.
Again, that's 50% federal, 50% state.
That's on fiscal year 19?
Fiscal year 15 through fiscal year 19, yes.
Okay. Oh, all right. There you go. And you're saying that the new CS that we've done, if I heard you correctly, doesn't really move that number, in your opinion, at this point?
That's my understanding. You've adopted this, and we will provide either an update or stand by this fiscal note by the next meeting.
Which would be on Thursday.
Thursday, yes.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure we're all talking the same thing.
Yeah, we're... Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what we're talking about. I don't expect to change, but I think to be fair to our staff, we need to give them the time to look at it and confirm that.
Okay. Representative Keller.
John, forgive me, but if we don't pass this bill, you will continue to pay this anyway. I am confused. I mean, if you're paying the for Medisets right now, I want to know, what the increase is all about. I don't mean to be difficult. I'm just trying to understand. So,
through the chair, I've had the same conversation with our pharmacy staff to make sure I understand, and we believe that the language in this bill will require us to, as written, essentially increase the frequency of the dispensing fee, or in other in other way make an equivalent increase in the combined dispensing fee, MedSet fee, and I'll just stop there because I.
We'll wait.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because I think we're going to go down this road a little bit further once we have as much information as you have. I'm with you, Representative Keller, to look at that.
I think Representative Tarr has a question.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If now would be an okay time, just in our last couple minutes, this addresses the point we're talking about, the amendment?
Okay. Not yet. We have to do...
Well, one, I'd have to remove my objection to that. And if we're fine, I don't have a problem with my objection. I would also suggest that we probably, if we're going to take it up in more in detail on Thursday, that we hold off on the amendment until Thursday.
If I might suggest that if we can get a description of a little bit of time, because if it has an impact fiscally, that'd be good for John.
Let's go ahead and hear the...
Let me start by removing my objection so that now it's the working document R is what we're under.
Right. Remove your... Thank you. And now, I think we have an amendment for us. So, let's see here. And go ahead and move it.
Sure. I'll move amendment number one.
Object.
Object.
For discussion.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. And I think in the end, I'll ultimately have to remove this amendment, but I wanted to bring it up right now because we're in the conversation about the cost of this. And I know cost containment for Medicaid, for the Medicaid program is a priority for everyone. And so when I looked at the fiscal note, I was concerned just about the size of the fiscal note. And in my mind, it seemed like at some point there must be a certain number of prescriptions, because this would be a dispensing fee per prescription that would cover all of your fees. So I was thinking back to my grandmother, who was 90 right before she passed. I think she was on, you know, a dozen or more medications each day, and was thinking there must be a point where if you're providing a MediSet for 5 medications or 10 medications, you know, where your costs have been covered. And so I was looking for a way to sort of put a cap on the fee in an effort to reduce the fiscal note. Why I wanted to bring it up now, and I think Representative Keller might be interested, is after thorough discussion with the department and the sponsor's office, I guess there's not actually a way to do this logistically in terms of trying to have a volume limitation or set a cap on the fee. So I don't think at this time, you know, I'll probably remove the amendment, but I wanted to bring that up, like I say, for discussion purposes, because was really trying to work in a way that we could reduce the fiscal impact of this while also, you know, making sure that the service was provided. And maybe if we just have another moment or two, you could speak to sort of why this isn't a good opportunity for cost containment. And I'll keep looking for another opportunity, I suppose, but I guess there's not actually an easy way to set a high volume limit as it's been explained to us.
So, okay, so that's discussion on the amendment.
Yes.
And you have a question.
Yes. Now. So, yeah, so, and I guess if the department could respond to that, you know, conversation that we've had for other members to understand the purpose of the amendment and why it won't accomplish what we had hoped.
Do you understand the question?
Ms. Chair, I think I understand the question. I guess the question I have is to make sure I have the right amendment in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
I was given something, and I apologize, I came late, that was, I guess, is Y.1.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the amendment?
Right.
We have discussed the possibility of trying to put a limit on the number of MediSet fees when you have multiple prescriptions in the same MediSet. Is there a number? That's not really practical to do because we process the prescriptions essentially one at a time in a point of sale system, and it would be very difficult for us to try and oversee that. It would sort of place the pharmacies on an honor system, kind of force them to do some sort of calculations perhaps on the fly if we wanted to do that. The amendment in front of me, as I read it, would allow us to discount the Medicet fee if a pharmacy was dispensing a high volume of Medicets. And I guess I would say, in looking at the proposals, we assume that we would have the latitude to do that if our cost survey data would support that kind of cost, that sort of fee structure, because we have to relate it to the costs we can come up with in our cost survey data. So we sort of, in terms of as a cost-saving measure, I think we assumed that we would have the latitude to do that if necessary. Would that affect our assessment of the cost? No. Would it be problematic clarifying that we had that authority? No. So I guess I just leave it at that, unless there's other questions.
So now let's get back to the amendment then. So do you want to pull your amendment, or what's your intent here?
Well, it's the will of the committee. I would like the department to pursue every opportunity at cost containment within fulfilling the goal of providing Medicet prescriptions. If this is an opportunity that would give more direct language, I think I would support adoption. I certainly don't want to hinder the program, but like I say, it just seems like there should be a point where the costs have been covered by the pharmacy at some point if you're getting paid $5 per prescription, for example, and you've filled, five and you've got $25, did that cost, or 10? At some point your costs have been covered, I would think, by the same person standing in the same area dispensing meds from the same cupboard of prescriptions, drugs available, right? So if I'm just envisioning standing in a pharmacy and actually, sort of pulling the bottles down, and just seems like there'd be a point where all the costs have been covered, and if there were opportunities for the department to use that as a sort of a cap, a high limit on what fee would be paid, then I would support that as a cost containment measure.
So, all right. So then if I understand this right, if this amendment, I guess in the department's eyes, but I know you just have just looked at this. If we do adopt this amendment and put it in, would it help to bring down the fiscal note? I suppose without really having your experts look at it, I don't know if you can answer that.
Sure. We don't think it would affect the fiscal note because, and I did have a brief opportunity to discuss this amendment with our pharmacy folks. The way the amendment is written, that we would have a discounted fee for high volume pharmacies. We had really assumed that we would have the latitude to do that. Our regular dispensing fee right now is lower if you do higher volume dispensing. So in a sense, we're already doing that as part of the combined Medicet dispensing fee. So it wouldn't bring our fiscal note down. What I said was, we certainly don't see a problem with having language giving us the clear ability to discount in the statute. That's we don't anticipate there'd be any problem with that. We just don't think it would affect our fiscal note because we've already kind of factored in that possibility. Again, if the cost survey data would support making that kind of distinction, because ultimately we have to tie it back to findings of cost.
Well, now I think it's back to you, Representative Tarr.
Maybe just comment on this if you would. You would go out, let's say if you're serving a facility or an organization or whatever, I would assume you would have a group of clients that would be serving. I mean, do we bid? How do you do this? I mean, how do you get do you select between different pharmacies, or does the doctor and the patient select the pharmacy? And I would think that a group buying, would be different than an individual buying. And I just very complex in my head. I don't know how it works.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, this really falls under the class of Medicaid services that essentially we use the phrase any willing provider. So if you meet the qualifications for being a provider, if you meet the qualifications for being a pharmacy, licensed pharmacy, you can enroll to be a pharmacy provider. The choice of pharmacies is the client's choice, the recipient's choice. In terms of how we set the prices looking at some national data on the price of the drug. And I'm going to say this in the most general terms and tell you that if I need to correct myself, I will come back on Thursday and correct myself. Because again, I'm not the specialist here, but we send out a cost survey to all the Medicaid participating pharmacies, and we have basically complete compliance in terms of returning the surveys. Then we look at the cost data. We get costs for operation of the different pharmacies, and we use that data to determine dispensing fees. And so we can, if the data suggests that there's different costs of dispensing for higher volume pharmacies versus lower volume pharmacies, then we can make a distinction in dispensing fees based on those volumes. We might find it relates more to other characteristics, on the road, off the road, something like that. But basically, we look at those cost data that we get from the surveys, and we find out the best, sort of the best, most reasonable way to approximate the cost of dispensing for the pharmacies in the state.
Just real quickly.
Okay, because we're out of time.
No, we're out of time. Because of the complexity and because I think we're all trying to get our head around it, I would request that Representative Tarr withdraw her amendment. And that way we're dealing with the, but that's just a request.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'm not opposed to that. I wanted to be able to have the conversation, so I'll remove amendment number one. And just it is a complex issue, and I've tried to find opportunities for reducing the cost of it while not reducing the service, and have not been successful yet, but since we're holding it, I'll keep trying.
Okay. Okay, thank you. All right. Any more questions? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to clarify one thing, and the way I answered the question about what are the costs involved in our fiscal note, because I addressed one half of the equation, or in terms of dollars, slightly more than one half, $1 million. The other part of it, the $657,000, is an anticipated expansion of service into Fairbanks. That was based on some of the information provided by supporters of the bill, that they anticipated expansion. Whether or not that specific expansion happens, it at least serves as a kind of a proxy for potential expansion of service that could happen under the bill. So there are really two pieces, and in kind of addressing the one issue that I thought you were asking specifically about, I think I may have given people the wrong impression that other cost wasn't in there. So.
Thank you. Thank you. And no more questions for the department? Thank you.
Thank you.
Did the sponsor want to speak to the amendment or not? Because we withdrew it. So I know you left a note.
I believe Mr. Sherwood addressed
it. Address it. Okay.
No worries.
Okay. Well, if there basically is no more discussion, we're going to hold this bill over till next Thursday. And we will be hearing it again on Thursday. And like I said, you got to remember, we're running into the last days here, and we have a lot going on. So with that, we will see. Our next committee house meeting will be 3 p.m. on Thursday, April the 4th.
All right.
And we will adjourn.
Thank you.